Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It's funny about zucchini. When you're overrun with it, you're overrun with it, and you're trying to find ways to deal with it and to give it away and to preserve it. But then when it's gone, you immediately want some more. So,
Lori Heber of Terra Foods. She's joined by two other garden and kitchen experts to talk about some practical and creative ways to use the bounty you're harvesting from your garden right now. Part two from Harvest Public Media about how farmers in Colorado are trying to revive their soil. We talked to author Bill Best about seed saving and cherry tomatoes, fresh from the garden, cooked up in a simple way by Chef Daniel Orr, and a sweet treat. Stay with us. Lots going on in the food world this week. Lou Anne Johnson has the headlines.
Call it what you will, cultured beef, Frankenburger, or even schmeat. On Monday, two foodies called it lunch. It took 3 months and 20,000 tiny strands of cells to make a single 5-ounce lab-grown hamburger patty. Supporters see this as more than a mad science stunt. The sustainability arguments are strong. A study at Oxford University and the University of Amsterdam found that industrial schmeat production would consume 45% less energy than conventional cattle farming, use up 99% less land, and produce 96% less greenhouse gas emissions. Many animal rights activists have also lauded the idea of substituting painless laboratory meat for the flesh of butchered animals. But vegetarians and philosophers remain divided on the ethics of lab-made meat. Paul Thompson is a philosophy professor at Michigan State University who specializes in agricultural ethics. He says the lab burger is interesting because it challenges the way we categorize food. Since the meat is grown without nerve tissue or a neural network, it seems clear that the process doesn't produce suffering. But Thompson adds, quote, "We really don't know," unquote. In the wake of a rare stomach bug outbreak, some infected are suing while others are waiting for answers. Cyclospora is a single-cell parasite that causes painful stomach and bowel issues, the effects of which can last sometimes for months. It is more common in tropical countries, and U.S. outbreaks have been traced to imported food. Since the first cases in June, 425 people have reported infection in 16 states, with 24 of those landing in the hospital. The first cases in Iowa and Nebraska have been traced to Taylor Farms in Mexico, the supplier for Olive Garden and Red Lobster Restaurant's salad mix. But consumers aren't breathing easy just yet. The FDA is still seeking the cause of illness in 14 other states, including Texas, where Darden Restaurants, the parent of Olive Garden and Red Lobster, does not use Taylor Farms. The FDA is working to see if salad mixes ended up on the consumer grocery shelves as well. There was no widely accepted definition of what makes a food gluten-free until last week. The FDA's new standard says in order for a food company to market or label a food as gluten-free, it must contain no more than 20 parts per million of gluten. Federal food officials say the new rule brings more clarity to the fast-growing market for gluten-free foods. Sales of gluten-free foods could hit $5 billion in the next 2 years. And good news in the fight against childhood obesity. For the first time, a major government report has shown a consistent pattern of decline in obesity for low-income children. Rates among preschool-aged children from poor families fell in 19 states between 2008 and 2011 after decades of rising numbers. Researchers aren't sure why the decline has happened, but it could be thanks to a drop in calories from sugary drinks. In interviews, parents imply they are more aware of the health problems that come from being overweight. So they are keeping an eye on their family's eating habits. Researchers are skeptical anti-obesity programs have contributed to declining rates. Read more about these stories on our website, eartheats.org. Links are provided in this week's podcast post.
Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie are our wonderful news bloggers. Lou Anne Johnson reads the headlines. Thanks, Lou Anne.
My pleasure.
The world's soil is in trouble. Ecologists say without dramatic changes to how we manage land, vast swaths of grassland are at risk of turning into hard-packed desert. Farmers and ranchers know in a few decades they'll have to feed a lot more people while at the same time keep the soil healthy and make money doing it. Last week, we explored the ways Iowa farmers are preventing soil erosion with man-made prairies. Now, Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon takes us to eastern Colorado, where researchers are turning to some unexpected partners to revive the soil.
Conventional wisdom would tell you if you're seeing less grass on the land, rein in the cows. Nature Conservancy ecologist William Burnage says that's not entirely true.
Plants actually respond to grazing. It actually stimulates growth in some ways.
We're standing just beyond a fence at the Fox Ranch, a few miles west of the Kansas border. The 14,000-acre property, owned by the Nature Conservancy, is part of a grand experiment. Researchers are putting in practice something called holistic management, or planned grazing.
So here's the ranch.
A large sheet of paper shows the ranch in full. A green trough snakes across the map.
That's the Rickery River.
I'm guessing a map like this probably plays pretty heavily into the planning process.
Boy, we use the map a lot. Yeah, the yellow lines on the map are the fences.
This is way more involved than your average rotational grazing system, which many ranchers already use. Here's how planned grazing works. A detailed chart drives every decision made on the ranch. At the beginning of each season, you plot out your moves on the map, like a Monopoly board. Better grass on the eastern side, you'll keep your cows there longer, but not too long. The cattle have to keep moving. The thought is the animals' hooves push on the soil, helping it to retain more rainfall.
You're only ever approximating what wild animals did, you know, when there weren't any people or fences to tell them what to do. But it's reasonable to think that they tried to stay on the forage that was best for them at the time.
The most common word tied to the planned grazing movement is mimicry, as in mimicking the prehistoric herds of large mammals that moved across the Great Plains. But the philosophy behind holistic management goes further. Ranchers should make a living using it.
When I learned about it, about that style of grazing, you know, the basis was everybody was producing more grass.
That's Nathan Andrews, the young rancher who leases the Fox Ranch to run his cattle.
And it's hard to, as a producer, to argue with more grass because we never have enough grass.
At the Fox Ranch, the emphasis is on documentation because the Nature Conservancy wants evidence that this approach works before telling other ranchers to try it out. The godfather of this grazing technique is Alan Savory. He's a world-renowned activist who wants to pull ranchers across the world out of poverty. He splits his time between New Mexico and Zimbabwe.
We really get the animals in the right place at the right time, for the right reason, with the right behavior.
Savory says his style of grazing management focuses on the soil and how the cattle interact with it.
We're getting the rain that falls on the ground to soak in more, run off less, but to remain in the soil and leave the soil through the vegetation or to underground water.
But if you think the entire rangeland community is singing Kumbaya, you're wrong. Savory's methods are controversial. Most of contemporary rangeland science says Savory's basic tenets, increased cattle numbers and rapid-fire grazing, have no basis. In fact, many rangeland ecologists say the only way to improve grassland is to reduce, not increase, the number of animals on it. Back at Fox Ranch, the experiment is just in its initial phases. Last year, even in the midst of drought, rancher Nathan Andrews was able to build up his herd, while many other ranchers were shedding their numbers. He counts that as a success.
So if we can benefit from it in two of the worst years on record, then I think moving forward with it will be even more beneficial.
Beneficial for his bottom line and the soil he depends on. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. Boom, 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 boom. We're harvesting zucchinis, tomatoes, and beans from the garden this time of year. Now, how to cook all this fresh produce? That is the question. I was thrilled to be joining Bob Zaltzberg on WFIU's Noon Edition last week. Our topic was cooking your garden. We were joined by three local foodies who definitely know how to harness all that goodness coming out of their gardens. Marcia Veldman is with the Bloomington Community Farmers Market. She's also a grower. This year has been remarkable for her farm, especially when compared to the difficulties of last year's drought.
The only thing right now is the cool temperatures are kind of holding back the ripening of tomatoes. Mm-hmm. They just like a little more heat to get that good summer ripeness.
Stephanie Solomon of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard is eagerly awaiting the ripening of tomatoes. She says canning tomatoes and other fruits and veggies now opens up a wide variety of possibilities for dishes later in the year.
I also love green beans, and I've been excited about at the farmer's market finding multicolored green beans, just all how you can pickle them and just steam them with garlic and lemon juice. They're one of my seasonal favorites.
Back to tomatoes. That's what Lori Heber of Terra Foods has an abundance of these days. She's making gallons and gallons of marinara sauce.
That's my favorite thing to make with tomatoes. Tide me through the winter and have a great go-to thing in the pantry. And then lots of zucchini. We've been blessed with amazing zucchini. So it's funny about zucchini. When you're overrun with it, and you're trying to find ways to deal with it and to give it away and to preserve it. But then when it's gone, you immediately want some more. So it's a challenge. I've been blanching and freezing zucchini in all different forms and manners so that it's ready to go for soups and stews come winter.
Let's talk a little bit about zucchini specifically. I've got a chocolate zucchini cake recipe here that I know I swear by. I'm making this all the time because I have so many zucchinis. Freezing zucchinis. You can also pickle them if you don't have cucumbers. You can pickle zucchinis. Mm-hmm. Other suggestions you guys have?
Well, what's big in the food pantry right now, our nutrition educator, Kate Young, really loves zucchini fritters. So on the days that we've gotten a lot of zucchini and summer squash coming through Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, the food pantry, we've been making fritters in our new kitchen. We have a kitchen at our new facility, and then having folks taste them in the pantry. And I personally love it because it makes the whole building smell fantastic, and it's pretty simple. She does a simple pan fry and a few spices. There would be an opportunity to use whatever herbs that you have in your garden growing right now. But yeah, it's one of the things I like about it, and we try to do this at Mother Hubbard's, is the simplicity of it. We try to do recipes that require few ingredients. So if folks don't have many ingredients at home besides what they're getting from the pantry, it's still possible to go home and try that recipe.
The beautiful thing about, you know, having something in your fridge and not knowing what to do with it, Google it. The internet is an amazing place. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking on the website, grilled peaches, grilled tofu. I know this season I've grilled Swiss chard leaves just with olive oil and salt and pepper. What are some other weird, interesting, unusual things we could plop on the grill?
I don't know that this is too unusual, but I absolutely love grilled onions. They just taste fantastic on the grill, especially a sweet onion on the grill.
Yeah, one of the things that I really like to do, and this is great, kind of a kitchen sink or actually anything out of the fridge kind of recipe, is I'll have a little bit of green pepper here and a little bit of onion here and a little bit of eggplant and a little bit of zucchini, maybe some mushrooms, and I'll cut them up into bite-sized pieces, put them in a bowl with some olive oil, salt and pepper, a little lemon zest, and some fresh oregano. And then put them into a grill pan and saute them up almost like you would in a wok. And the nice thing about that mixture is that you can either serve it alongside a pasta or a rice dish, but then it also, whatever leftovers you might have the next day, go on a pizza really well, and they just serve in a wide variety of things. So you can get one cooking on the grill with a wide variety of things that have come out of your refrigerator and then extend them through the week and use them in a variety of ways.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about freezing. Marcia, you and I were talking about this before the show started. Can you freeze anything?
You can freeze a lot, that's for sure. Yeah, I have a chest freezer, and I find it's just the easiest way to put up produce. I used to always blanch tomatoes and skin them before sticking them in the freezer, and now I just wash and core them and leave the skin on. I do have a vacuum packer, which really helps to hold the moisture in and prevent some freezer burn. But, yeah, I'll put up 50 gallons of tomatoes in the freezer and freeze lots of fruits, berries. I know someone was asking about what to do with basil, and I freeze basil, too, in ice cube trays. So I'll just put the basil in a food processor with some water, put it in ice cube trays, add a little more water so it's topped off, and then you have cubes that you can pop into soups and sauces and that sort of thing. And it's a real nice, easy way to hang on to the basil, that summer flavor in the wintertime.
That's brilliant. You know, I pulled up a website article, too, on smartlivingnetwork.com, and it shows, you know, you've got a bunch of basil. Sure, we all know that we can make pesto, but you can also do strawberry basil salad with some feta cheese. You've got mint. You can do it maybe as a topping for a cake, but then you can also make a mint gazpacho with cucumbers. So, you know, maybe people can reimagine these old-fashioned recipes. Gazpacho doesn't have to be red with tomatoes.
Peaches? Yeah, peach tomato gazpacho is really nice.
Great.
I tried a lemonade recipe the other day, which was muddled blueberries and basil that was strained then and mixed with a little bit of sugar and a little bit of lemon juice. It was delicious.
Listen for more tips about cooking the bounty you're harvesting from your garden next week. Canning and pickling, you'll get lots of info about that. Subscribe to our podcast to make sure you don't miss an episode. On iTunes, just search for Earth Eats. Coming up,
it's fairly common in certain parts of the world to combine the sweet and the heat in a dessert.
Chef Daniel Orr spent some time cooking in the Caribbean, so he should know. He shows us a recipe for nut brittle that satisfies your sweet tooth and your need for heat. Come back to hear it. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. We're on the phone all the time talking to authors of cookbooks, how-to books, food policy books. Today, we're featuring a snippet of my conversation with Bill Best. His new book, Saving Seeds, Preserving Taste, tells the stories of seed savers in Appalachia. When I asked him why he saves seeds, he says it was the most important thing he could do as a gardener.
So much of modern plant breeding has been a crime against humanity because why should we create a protein-free bean and a lycopene-free and vitamin-free tomato, you know, just so that they will be able to ship great distances, be harvested by machine, then sit on a shelf for 35 days, and then not have any food value once they're eaten.
He has heirloom seeds from his mother's garden that still germinate after 35 years. In his book, he tells the story of seeds that originated during the Civil War that are still being planted today.
Here's 1 minute where Bill Best talks about his most successful heirloom seed for a bean he calls the non-tough half runner.
Beans, for example, tend to mutate fairly readily, and I think that's why we have so many varieties of beans right now. Mutations would appear in the field periodically or garden periodically, and they would be called sports. That's the colloquial term for a mutant plant. Usually the matriarch of the family would save those seeds, grow them the next summer, and if they bred true, there would be plenty of them to try out in the kitchen. And then if they were an excellent seed stock, then they would be kept and become a part of that family's lore, and then shared within the extended family and then within the community. And then beans like that often go region-wide. I've got one myself that I call the non-tough half runner. You know, the problem with commercial half runners is their toughness. You have to throw away over half of them. And so I have the one I call the non-tough half runner that is far and away our best-selling bean.
Great. Thanks, Bill. I appreciate the time.
Yeah. You're very welcome.
All right. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Learn more about Bill Best and his book, Saving Seeds, Preserving Taste, on his website, heirlooms.org. Tis the season for cherry tomatoes. We've got tips on our website if you're looking to save tomato seeds, eartheats.org. If you're more interested in eating the fruits, Chef Daniel Orr has a really simple recipe that lets the bright taste of fresh tomatoes shine through.
Cherry tomatoes are another one of those volunteers in the garden. Every year they come back and they kind of make their own routine. We planted our tomato plants in June and July, but they grow really quickly. We've got all the different kinds. We've got some little tiny currant ones. We've got some pear-shaped ones. We've got the typical round Sweet 100 style. And each one of these tomatoes has a different flavor, a different texture. Some are really nice for sauces. Others are great in soups and salads. We've got our cherry tomatoes as well as a couple heirloom varieties. We've got our basil here. And what we're going to do is do some burst cherry tomatoes. And what that means is we're going to put some really hot oil in a pan, add the cherry tomatoes until the skins start to burst off of them, then we'll add the rest of the ingredients. And then you could use it for all kinds of things. You could use it on top of a toasted bread for kind of a crostini. You could throw it over pasta. You could serve it over some sautéed kale. But this is a nice way that you can use the summer bounty of cherry tomatoes. We are going to use some decent quality olive oil here. We're going to add our tomatoes. We're going to add some garlic. Now we're going to let that go until it gets a little toasty and brown. And you can see the skins of the tomatoes are starting to burst. We're going to add a little bit of lemon zest. Be careful with the smoke alarm going off.
Crisis averted. And we're back.
I'm just going to tear up the basil. You don't want to chop basil much because it bruises it. This way it retains more of its flavor. I'm going to toss that and then finish it with some Parmesan cheese. So you have this wonderful tomato compote. And I'm just going to pour that out onto this tart shell. Now you could use toast, you could use baguette. And that makes a perfect little starter for your next summer dinner party.
We're skipping the main course and going right to dessert, and why not? Now, we're not kidding ourselves with this recipe. This is not healthy, but it is fun.
All right. Okay. Thought we'd do something sweet today, but you know me, a little sweet, a little spicy. So we're going to do a Caribbean-style nut brittle. So it's kind of like a peanut brittle, but we use all different kinds of nuts. We're going to take a large-bottomed pan, wider than it is tall, and with flat sides. And we just put the sugar in there to cover the bottom. And 1 cup of corn syrup. Now, usually I don't use much corn syrup, but in this case, it really makes a peanut brittle that lasts a long time, doesn't get sticky too quick. Every once in a while, you gotta splurge a little bit. We're going to cook them until they start to caramelize and turn brown.
The other thing that the corn syrup does is that it keeps the sugar from seizing up, which means it keeps it from getting real granular. So it's just one of those chemical things that does have its advantages for certain recipes. So we just really want to let it sit there until it starts to turn brown. It does go from brown to black really quick, so you don't want to leave the kitchen when you're doing this, and maybe wait for that glass of wine until after you've made the brittle. Okay, you can see here we're starting to get a little golden there. It looks a little bit like the Golden Girls. Sweet, bubbly, effervescent, and a little bitter. Okay, and when we start getting that color, we're getting close. You can see it's getting foamy, almost looks like a head of a glass of beer. And it's important at this point to keep it stirred.
The color's also changing a little bit.
Yeah, you can see it's getting more and more dark. And the more you caramelize sugar, the less calories it has in it. And that's true.
Sounds like something I would tell myself to convince me that I'm eating something not quite so bad for me.
We want to fight that, so we're going to add some butter to it.
Thank goodness, right?
Now we're going to add our seasonings. Chili flakes, regular red pepper chili flakes, ginger, salt, sweet seasons powder, which you could also use Chinese five spice powder. Okay, now we're going to add the nuts. I've got some toasted walnuts and some mixture of macadamia nuts, almonds, and pumpkin seeds. We're starting to work quick. I'm going to add the butter, 2 tablespoons. Okay, and finally, some baking soda. And the baking soda is what's going to make it real fluffy.
And that base now is almost like a brick, dark brick red.
Yeah. Want to really coat everything, turn it, make sure everything's enrobed in the sugar. Okay, now I've got a sheet tray. I'm just going to spray it with a little nonstick spray. Pour out the brittle. And then we'll just pat it out so it's an even layer. Great crumbled on top of ice cream. Chop it up and sprinkle it on things, on crepes, on pancakes for breakfast. So you can really enjoy this throughout the day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Sweet and spicy nut brittle for breakfast. I like it. If you come up with more unique ways to use this stuff, we want to know about it. Send us comments, pictures, and recipes to eartheats@gmail.com. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Bill Best, Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Lori Heber, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Stephanie Solomon, Marcia Veldman, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. We appreciate your company today. Good food to us all. I'm Annie Corrigan.